You can get some further insight into the likely effects of September 11th by looking back a few years to the preceding moment when it was widely argued that there would be a crucial turning point in world affairs, namely the end of the Cold War. That was definitively over by November 1989 with the fall of the Berlin Wall. So what do we learn from that historic break? Well, I think if you look back now with 13 years experience, we discover primarily continuity. Some tactical modifications, lots of new pretexts for old policies, but basically the same policies, the ones I've just outlined, which are indeed natural, just as the National Security Council recognized, deeply rooted in our institutions and therefore persistent. So let's take October 89, right before the fall of the wall. A national security directive on the Middle East recommended continued support for our friend Saddam Hussein, called for the use of military force where necessary and appropriate to defend our vital interests against the Soviet Union or any other regional power, not Iraq, notice. A couple of weeks later, the Berlin Wall fell. A few months later, in March 1990, George Bush, number one, sent the annual message to Congress on the Pentagon budget, same as previous years. We need a huge Pentagon budget, but now the pretexts were changed. So we still needed a huge intervention force directed at the Middle East, where, I'm quoting, the threats to our interests could not be laid at the Kremlin's door. That's contrary to the preceding October and all the years before. In fact, the threats were exactly the same as they had always been, namely indigenous nationalism. Just as in 1958, when it was internally conceded that there were no Russians, or in Latin America or Southeast Asia or Africa. In fact, if you look closely, consistently. So the policies therefore continue, but now it's not in defense against the Russians because they're not there anymore. Other policies remain intact as well. In March 1990, we still needed the enormous military system, not to deter the Russians, but in defense against the technological sophistication of third world powers. And it's necessary to maintain what they call the defense industrial base, it's a euphemism for high-tech industry, as before, the Pentagon system has to remain in order to provide a cover for the dynamic state sector of the economy that serves to socialize risk and cost while privatizing profit, and it shields concentrated private power from market discipline. It's a leading factor in economic development and in the creation of the so-called new economy, and it also has to be extended without substantial change. Same after September 11th, but just intensified. Well, back to 1990, military tactics did change. The Pentagon explained at the time that the international environment has changed from the targets being weapon-rich, that's a name reference to the Soviet Union, to being target-rich, that's a reference to the South, the rest of the former colonial world, where there are increasingly capable third world threats. It's the Joint Chief of Staff at March 1990, quite in conformity with the public message to Congress. Targets are now going to include nations capable of developing weapons of mass destruction. Well, who are they? Any nation is capable of developing weapons of mass destruction if it has some laboratories, a little bit of industry, some infrastructure, so that's just about everyone. The South is to be specifically targeted, as indeed had been true throughout the whole Cold War period, but now new options are available because the deterrent is gone, so we can do it more openly and with less, fewer devious means. Nuclear weapons remain the centerpiece of U.S. strategy, but now enhanced to include what are called mini-nukes, which are tailored for use against rogue elements, and these change now and then. So in 1988, shortly before, Nelson Mandela's African National Congress was designated officially as one of the more notorious terrorist organizations in the world, while South Africa was a valued ally, having killed only 1.5 million people in the surrounding areas, forget South Africa itself, just in the Reagan years. That was part of the war against international terrorism, which is now redeclared by the same people. a few years later, that calculation changed, and the recent past goes right down the memory hole, teaching us absolutely nothing. Returning to post-Cold War planning, Clinton's Strategic Command recommended that nuclear weapons should be used, when needed, in what they called preemptive reaction. I'll leave it to you to figure that one out. But even if they're not used, they cast a shadow over any crisis or conflict, so they must be available and visible to adversaries. The U.S. must also move on to placing offensive weapons in space. It's in violation of the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, which has so far been observed. And at the UN, it's been reaffirmed in the last few years, the U.S. and Israel abstaining. It's being reaffirmed because everybody knows the U.S. is planning to violate it. And for good reasons, which are clearly explained in Clinton-era documents of the Space Command, they point out that in the past, navies were created in order to protect commercial interests and investments. And space is the next frontier, and we are powerful enough to monopolize it. War planners, furthermore, accept the same projections as the intelligence community. They also anticipate a growing gap between what they call the haves and the have-nots as the preferred style of globalization proceeds. Therefore, it follows that we need enormous destructive power in space, on hair trigger alert, in order to control the unruly have-nots who are going to be extending with globalization. Well, these Clinton-era documents go on to give quite a chilling analysis of the intended future. They're actually not very different from the recently leaked nuclear posture review of the Bush administration, which created a considerable stir when it was leaked to military analyst William Arkin a couple of weeks ago and published. The difference in reaction raises a number of questions, but I'll put that aside and keep to the main point, which is that the basic policies remain stable through two recent critical moments, the collapse of the Soviet Union and September 11th. The primary effect of the redeclared war on terror has been to provide the United States with a major military base in Central Asia for the first time. That puts the U.S. in a strong position to dominate the energy resources of Central Asia, but also, and I think more important, it complements the intervention system that's aimed at the far richer Gulf oil reserves. That goes from Guam to the Azores, but the closest nearby base up until now was the island of Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean, from which the population was expelled. The British courts have since accepted their plea, it's British Island, their plea that they have a right to return, but there's a higher authority which overturns that decision.